God Almighty, walk before me and be blameless. I will confirm my covenant between me and you and will greatly increase your numbers. Abram fell face down, and God said to him, As for me, this is my covenant with you. You will be the father of many nations. No longer will you be called Abram. Your name will be Abraham, for I have made you a father of many nations. I will make you very fruitful. I will make nations of you, and kings will come from you. I will establish my covenant as an everlasting covenant between me and you and your descendants after you for the generations to come, to be your God and the God of your descendants after you. The whole land of Canaan, where you are now an alien, I will give as an everlasting possession to you and your descendants after you, and I will be their God. Then God said to Abraham, As for you, you must keep my covenant, you and your descendants after you, for the generations to come. This is my covenant with you and your descendants after you, the covenant you are to keep. Every male among you shall be circumcised. You are to undergo circumcision, and it will be the sign of the covenant between me and you. For the generations to come, every male among you who is 8 days old must be circumcised, including those born in your household or bought with money from a foreigner, those who are not your offspring. Whether born in your household or bought with your money, they must be circumcised. My covenant in your flesh is to be an everlasting covenant. Any uncircumcised male who has not been circumcised in the flesh will be cut off from his people. He has broken my covenant. God also said to Abraham, As for Sarai, your wife, you are no longer to call her Sarai. Her name will be Sarah. I will bless her and will surely give you a son by her. I will bless her so that she will be the mother of nations. Kings of peoples will come from her. Abraham fell face down. He laughed and said to himself, Will a son be born to a man 100 years old? Will Sarah bear a child at the age of 90? And Abraham said to God, If only Ishmael might live under your blessing. Then God said, Yes, but your wife Sarah will bear you a son, and you will call him Isaac. I will establish my covenant with him as an everlasting covenant for his descendants after him. And as for Ishmael, I have heard you. I will surely bless him. I will make him fruitful and will greatly increase his numbers. He will be the father of 12 rulers, and I will make him into a great nation. But my covenant I will establish with Isaac, whom Sarah will bear to you by this time next year. When he had finished speaking with Abraham, God went up from him. On that very day, Abraham took his son Ishmael and all those born in his household or bought with his money, every male in his household, and circumcised them as God had told him. Abraham was 99 years old when he was circumcised, and his son Ishmael was 13. Abraham and his son Ishmael were both circumcised on that same day. And every male in Abraham's household, including those bought from a foreigner, was circumcised with him. Well, Christmas is coming, as I'm sure you've noticed. And it's only a couple of weeks to the shortest day. So maybe it's time we had a little think about this place. Have our first picture, please. Stonehenge from the air. And moving on. Another view. And you can see there the large upright stones called sarsens, and gathered round the base of them, there are some smaller blue stones. It's quite a spectacular place. I don't know if you've ever been, but it's worth going. Those large stones, the sarsens, some of those can weigh up to 40 tons. Now, they probably came from elsewhere in Wiltshire, There's a site around 19 miles away that seems very likely, so the experts say. And a 40-ton stone can be moved that distance if you've got, well, only about 200 people. Take them about 12 days, each of those big stones. The smaller stones, the blue stones, there's 45 of them remaining at Stonehenge now. They're estimated as weighing between 2 and 4 tons each. There's various types, but from the composition, it's been reckoned that they all come from the Preseli Hills in South Wales. That's a distance of about 150 miles. That's a heck of a way to bring 45 2-to-4-ton stones. It's quite a subtle place as well. A major job to position those upright stones in place. And they've been shaped so that they fit together carefully. There's mortise and tenon joints and tongue and groove joints in the stones. And the overall site, as you might have noticed on the first picture, resembles two horseshoes of stone inside two concentric circles of stone. And there's a main axis marked by what's called the heel stone outside that circular structure. And that main axis is aligned with sunrise on the longest day of the year and sunset on the shortest day of the year to give that kind of effect. It's a very special place. Well, obviously it was special to somebody. Why else would they go to all the trouble of taking those huge stones and making them in that very careful position? And it was built, so we gather, in various phases over the years, finishing round about 4,000 years ago. No sign that it was an inhabited site. It's not a site that could in any way be easily defended. And yet it was something very important to the people who made it and used it. So it seems likely that it had some kind of ritual or spiritual significance to them. But as for exactly what, nobody really knows. Meanwhile, at about the same time over in Mesopotamia, the area that nowadays is covered by Iraq, there was an even more sophisticated civilization. Their culture included pottery, irrigation, written records, foreign trade with places as far afield as Cyprus and India. In their markets, they sold jewelry, carpentry, leatherwork, they had shipbuilding. They were a very materialistic culture, but also a superstitious culture. They worshipped many gods, and they constructed huge temples called ziggurats, where there were many priests, temples to the moon god, such as this place. And from the vehicles in front of it, you get a feel for the size of that. Now, that one was a ziggurat roughly at Ur, and that one was rather rebuilt during Saddam Hussein's years in power in Iraq. But the final picture that I've got is a ziggurat at a place called Choghazanbil. Haven't been there, thank you Wikipedia. This is one of the best preserved examples of a ziggurat. Just bear in mind the size of that thing. And from Ur of the Chaldees in Mesopotamia came a man called Abraham, originally Abram, son of Terah. Quite a wealthy man. He probably had a very comfortable life in material terms back in Ur. But he left his home city with his family, took his household with him and his possessions, and went with his father Terah and his nephew Lot and their immediate families as far as Haran, 600 or 700 miles trek along the trade routes. And they settled there until Terah died. By that time, Abram was already getting elderly. He was about 75. And he felt God calling him on again. So he uprooted himself, took Sarai, his wife, Lot, his nephew, and their households, and they left Haran. And followed the trade routes further on, probably another 500 miles or so, into the land of Canaan. And that would have been a slow journey at walking speed with large herds of animals. I mean, this was a proper caravan. This was no tin box towed behind a Ford Fiesta. This was an extensive company of people. In Genesis 14, we read that on one occasion, Abram was able to deploy a fighting force of over 300 men who had been born in his household. He was a big chief, a big man. And he spent the rest of his life as a nomad, living in tents in a foreign land. And by the time we come to chapter 17, which we read earlier, Abram has been out of Haran for almost a quarter of a century. And then God appears to him. And it's a critical encounter. The focus in that encounter that we read is covenant and promise. Now, God had already made a covenant with Abram. You can read about that in chapter 15. It's a rather strange encounter. It was modelled on the covenants that were made between rulers in those times. Animals were slaughtered. They were cut in half. Two piles of animals were made. Two piles of the halves of animals were made on the ground. And the parties to the covenant walked between those piles of animals as if to say, may this be what happens to me if I break the covenant that I'm making with you. And at the end of Genesis 15, we read these words. When the sun had set and darkness had fallen, a smoking brazier with a blazing torch appeared and passed between the pieces. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram and said, to your descendants I give this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the Euphrates. God passed through alone, taking responsibility for the covenant that he was making with Abram. But the encounter in today's passage was much more detailed and much more specific. The word covenant occurs 10 times in the chapter that we read. The verses that we've just read from chapter 15 are the only other time where that word occurs in the story of Abraham. So what does this chapter say about covenant? First of all, in verse 2, as in chapter 15, it says that it's God's covenant. He made it. He took responsibility for it. Verse 7 tells us that it's a lasting covenant established for many generations to all Abraham's descendants. And it was a covenant tied to a promise of the land. Verse 8, the same land where God had sent Abram as a wandering foreigner would be the land that his descendants would inherit. More than that, this covenant was rich with promise. Verse 3, Abram was to become Abraham, the father of many. In his case, the father of many nations and even of kings. Verse 19, Sarai was included. She would be called Sarah. She would become a mother despite her age. She would be the mother of kings. Now, this couple had waited years for a son. It seemed impossible that they could have a child of their own. But now God gave them a clear promise and a time scale and a name for the baby, Isaac, meaning laughter, after Abraham fell down and laughed at the thought of it, and Sarah did the same. And yet this came true, as was promised, within the year. And there's a PS in verse 20 that God also heard Abraham's prayer for Ishmael. Ishmael was his son by the slave girl Hagar. If you read chapter 16, you can find the story of that. It was a thoroughly messy business. But even there, God was generous and gracious. And yet this was also a demanding covenant. Verses 9 to 14 of our passage talk about the sign for the covenant community. Every male had to be circumcised. The terms of the covenant were to be written on their bodies. There was no escape. It was a perpetual sign and a reminder of God's call to them. And notice that this was for all the males, not just for Abraham and his immediate descendants. That covenant was never about just one man. It was much more. It was about the building of a covenant community, but all based on God's prior commitment to Abraham in chapter 15. The encounter in chapter 15 was in some ways quite a private thing. Abram was there in the darkness, having sat there all day in communion with God. But this was something that was going to be very obvious. It was going to touch every part of the community that lived with Abraham. Why covenant? Well, you've perhaps seen from the notice sheet that the sermon series we've got for Advent goes under the title of Covenant and Promise. A covenant was an alliance, a treaty, an expression of relationship. Sometimes between equals, often there would be a senior and a junior party to the covenant. It was a setting for responsibilities and promises. And it's very much how God has dealt with people through history. Earlier, God made a covenant with Noah. We heard about Noah last week. Remember these words after the flood. Then God said to Noah and to his sons with him, I now establish my covenant with you and your descendants after you, and with every living creature that was with you. The birds, the livestock, and all the wild animals, all those that came out of the ark with you, every living creature on earth, I will establish my covenant with you. Never again will all life be cut off by the waters of a flood. Never again will there be a flood to destroy the earth. That promise from Genesis 9 included the earth, its people, and even its animal life. And now the next stage involves taking one good man. And so enter Abram. But why this man? Why this particular man from Ur of the Chaldees? Our title today describes him as a good man. But in what sense? I think the keys are very much faith and obedience. Abraham's faith was astonishing. We've already noted that he was a native of Ur of the Chaldees. He'd already had some kind of encounter there with this unknown God. Genesis 12, the Lord had said to Abram, leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. All the peoples on earth will be blessed through you. So Abram left, as the Lord had told him. We don't know many of the details of that first encounter. The next four chapters, from chapter 12 through to chapter 15 of Genesis, cover roughly 10 years, and in those 10 years we only read of five encounters that Abram had with God. And then there's nothing more until chapter 17, and that's another 14 years on. In between, as far as we know, there were no meetings, no visions, no dreams, just that long, slow journey. But still, Abram held his faith. There were huge uncertainties over his future and his posterity. He would be the father of nations. He would be a great nation. And yet, as I said, he and Sarai had no children. You can read of Abram's half-hearted, ill-judged attempt to resolve this conundrum. He took with him Lot, his nephew. When Lot was ruled out of the picture, then he talked about Eliezer of Damascus, probably his chief servant, who would become his heir if he died without children. He was ruled out. Then there was Ishmael, born to Hagar, as we said. And in this chapter, God said, no, not him. All of those solutions proved unsatisfactory. But still, Abram held his faith. Eventually, in chapter 21, we read how Isaac was born. And then not long afterwards, Abraham was called to sacrifice him, chapter 22. But still, Abraham held his faith. No wonder he is described with great honor. Three times in Scripture, we read that Abraham is called God's friend. Just one example comes from Isaiah 41, verse 8. But you, O Israel, my servant, Jacob, whom I have chosen, you descendants of Abraham, my friend. And in the New Testament, we find Abraham called the father of those who have faith, those who trust in God. Romans 4. Therefore, the promise comes by faith so that it may be by grace and may be guaranteed to all Abraham's offspring, not only those who are of the law, but also to those who are of the faith of Abraham. He is the father of us all. And that man from 4,000 years ago in Ur of the Chaldees is esteemed similarly by Christians, Jews, and Muslims. A man of great faith. But the other side of the coin is that Abraham's obedience was astonishing as well. When God called him, he left. First he left Ur, then he left Haran. He headed for Canaan. It wasn't a land that he knew. Maybe he'd never been there before. The only property he owned there was a burial plot that eventually he bought for his wife. He struggled to know God's ways properly. He made some dubious decisions along the way, but he was quick to obey the terms of the covenant when God spoke to him. Verse 23, did you notice? On that very day, Abraham took his son Ishmael and those born in his household and circumcised them. His faith produced obedience. By faith, Abraham, when called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, says Hebrews 11, obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. By faith, he made his home in the promised land, like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city with foundations, whose architect and builder is God. Remember, he had come from quite a well-established city. I think it's reckoned that Ur of the Chaldees had about 200,000 people, twice the size of Gloucester in Abraham's day. But he was looking for a better city. And James also brings out that link between faith and obedience. Chapter 2. Was not our ancestor Abraham considered righteous for what he did when he offered his son Isaac on the altar? You see that his faith and his actions were working together, and his faith was made complete by what he did. Abraham's faith and obedience challenges. It says in my notes here, pause for congregational interaction. Okay. Think of a Christian that you respect greatly. Who thinks their friend, the person they've thought about, knows more about God, than Abraham did? Any hands up? Who knows more? Who thinks their respected friend knows more about God? Well, I'm surprised, actually. Remember, Abraham didn't have any accounts of Jesus. He didn't have the fullness of the Spirit. He didn't have a Bible. Most of the events hadn't even happened, let alone been written down. And there were very few other believers around. But who thinks that their friend knows God better than Abraham did? I think Abraham probably had a closer walk with God than most of us manage. And if he walked in obedient faith before God with so little to go on, how much more should we? And behind all Abraham's faith and obedience, we have God's calling and God's purpose. Proverbs 15 verse 3 says, "The eyes of the Lord are everywhere, keeping watch on the wicked and the good." Just before Abram appeared on the scene, we read about the Tower of Babel, when human ingenuity, driven by human pride, tried to dominate the earth. It was a perverted parody of humanity's God-given stewardship over creation. Let's build a tower. Let's build a name for ourselves. We'll reach up to heaven. And God looked, and he saw the people's ambition, and he thwarted their scheming. And he planned their rescue from the mess they were making. He looked for a good man whom he could call Remember Genesis 12 again? God's calling to Abram to leave his home, his heritage and his household for another land, an unknown land, and to walk by faith. And God's purpose for Abram, to bless him, to make him a great nation, and through him to bless all the peoples of the earth. That promise was never solely for Abram, his immediate family, or the Jewish nation. Remember how the covenant sign affected all the males in his household, not just his relatives. Think back to a moment to our friends who built Stonehenge, those who built it and those who used it. Some of them were Abraham's contemporaries, and God watched them too. He saw their struggles to understand life and the world, and though we don't know what they did there, he knows what they were doing. He knows what they were looking for. He understands what they believed, what they hoped, what they feared. And similarly, right across the world, and from all these people, he picked that one man, Abram from Ur, and called him to bless all the peoples of the world through him. What about our contemporaries? Some of them still are fascinated by Stonehenge and its apparent earthy spirituality, its pagan spirituality. Some of our contemporaries are just trying to cope and make sense of life as best they can. Some of them believe in a god or gods. Some of them in reincarnation. Some of them probably in nothing. Some we just don't know what they believe, and maybe in some cases they're not sure themselves either. And yet God sees them all and knows them all and longs to reach out to them. And what about us? We share the covenant and promise that God gave to Abram of Ur. There is a clear progression from Abram becoming Abraham, through the Jewish nation to Christ, and through Christ to us. We share the faith of Abraham and are challenged to live as he did, setting light to the things of this world, being prepared to be flexible and responsive to God's call, being open to the vision of a heavenly reality, and remembering that sometimes that vision, that calling, that purpose may take us far beyond what is comfortable. We're to be obedient to whatever we're called to do by the God we serve. We have a much richer understanding available to us of what God wants. So do we manage the same level of faithfulness to God that Abraham did? We share Abraham's calling and purpose. They are God's calling and God's purpose. And he wants to bless the world through us, the church, the Christians. This is why he chose a good man, and why he still looks for those who will, by his grace, become good people. And how are we to do this? It's always the same. By the quality of our lives, demonstrating the character of Christ in the Spirit's power, showing by our relationships and by the servanthood that we offer that there is a better way than this world knows. And along with the quality of our lives, the clarity of our words, explaining the hope that God has given us in Jesus, and pointing to the bigger story of God at work in this world that he made. In this way, we are to live out the covenant that we have received. Because discipleship is for life, not just for Christmas. Let's pray.